Chapter 12. Brothers. The salamander is a sufficiently convincing example that everything which burns is not consumed, as the souls in hell are not. Saint Augustine. Tetrarch Dolor came to attention as Gilliman strode into the residence's Medicae hall. The Primarch was still wearing his ceremonial warplate and seemed too big and regal for the sub-level confines.
"My lord," said Dolor, "your brother has arrived, I gather."
"He waits upstairs," Gilliman replied. "There is conversation to be had."
"How does he seem?"
Gilliman's solemn face permitted a slight smile at the subtlety of the question.
"Like himself, Valentus, like the lion, he is suspicious, and I fear he has already in his mind decided to oppose the future we are trying to secure. I have yet to explain myself and my decisions to him. He has yet to show me that he accepts or even understands what I am about."
Dolor nodded.
"He is waiting," Gilliman added dryly, "and I have excused myself and come to you because you asked me to do so, and I know you would not waste my time or divert me unless it was critical."
Dolor nodded his head again, more a bow of appreciation.
"It is, my lord," he replied. "You need to see this. I believe you may be shocked. In truth, I cannot count whether it is reason to rejoice or mourn. Also, I would have spared you this concern when you are occupied with your noble brother, but you need to know this. You need to be in possession of this information before you take any further steps."
Gilliman studied his friend's face, but transhuman features were notoriously hard to read for micro-expressions.
"Then just show me," Gilliman said.
Dolor ushered his lord through the doorway into the guarded areas of the secure suite. Status bars on the wall plates displayed the fact that the area was held at vermilion-level security. The long line of guarded iris valves opened and closed behind them as they walked.
"This concerns the object that fell from the sky, doesn't it?" Gilliman asked as they walked.
"Yes, lord."
"The transhuman corpse?"
Dolor did not reply directly.
"You've established an origin?"
"Yes, lord."
"An identity?"
"Yes, lord."
Gilliman glanced at him sharply.
"Something else?" he asked.
"Something else, indeed, my lord," said Dolor.
They reached the gloomy inner chamber where the iron casket lay. Captain Casimir and Titus Praetor were waiting for them. They bowed to the Primarch and fell into step as Dolor led his lord through the laboratory chambers and into the isolation block beyond. The area was reserved for hazardous material and viral quarantine work. It was a long row of brightly lit cells, stark and white, each with a hermetically sealed armor glass wall facing into a common corridor. The corridor was lined with Ultramarines guards, and high-ranking Medicae personnel worked at cogitation and cellular sampling arrays that had been set up in the walkway facing one of the cells. Power cables snaked from the consoles across the grilled deck in fat rubber loops.
"Surely the mortal laboratory would have been a better venue for dissection," Gilliman began.
"I authorize the transfer of the patient," Dolor replied simply.
Gilliman stopped in his tracks so abruptly that Captain Casimir almost bumped into him.
"You said patient,"
Gilliman said quietly.
"My lord, I did," said Dolor. "By the stars of Ultramar, my lord, he is alive."
"How?" asked Gilliman.
He asked it first of Dolor, a mix of anger and incomprehension crossing his face.
"How? How?"
he repeated, turning to look at Casimir, Praetor, and the suddenly tense Medicae personnel.
"He healed, my lord," said Praetor.
"Healed?"
Gilliman snapped.
"He fell out of the damn sky, from orbit. He burned to a crisp and dove deep into the Civitas like a meteor. You don't heal from that."
"And yet," Dolor began,
May the old gods come and strike you all down as either liars or incompetents, Gilliman yelled. Whatever else you said, Dolor, you told me he was dead. Organic residue, a corpse, a cremated corpse. I did not lie, Dolor said calmly. He was utterly dead, utterly. All life sign was extinct, all brain function. There was no viable organic tissue on his charred bones whatsoever. Your best physicians and analysts confirmed this, and so did all the instrumentation of the Medicae Hall. He paused. He was dead, Lord. And then he was not. Life returned where life was not and could not be. He healed. You do not heal from death, Gilliman roared.
It appears you do, my lord, said Prato quietly, if you are one of the sons of mankind's emperor.
Silence. Gilliman turned to look at Prato. Titus Prato held his master's stare and nodded confirmation. Gilliman turned away and strode towards the occupied cell. Guards and personnel darted out of his path. He reached the thick armour-glass wall, stopped a few centimetres from it, and stared inside. The cell was a bare white space. A single male figure occupied the left-hand corner away from the glass. He was sitting on the floor, his back against the walls, his forearms resting on his raised knees. He was naked. He stared ahead towards some distant spot that was not in the room. He was a massive form, heavily muscled. The fire of his long fall had shriveled his corpse, but his stature, so much greater than human, was obvious now that he was restored to life. He possessed a Primarch's build, a being scaled to fit only the largest chairs in Gilliman's residency. There were no marks on his body, no hair. By whatever means he was healing, it was still happening. Every part of his skin was raw and bloody as some miraculous process brought living tissue out of burned residue. "I don't," Gilliman began, his breath making a fog on the surface of the glass wall. "Who is he?"
"It is Vulcan," said Dolor.
Gilliman gasped in pain and recognition.
"You are sure?"
"I'm certain," said Titus Prato.
Gilliman raised both hands and placed the palms against the armour glass on either side of his face, peering in. He paid no heed to the fact that both were jacketed in full ceremonial plate and massive, ornate lightning claws.
"Let me in there," Gilliman said, staring at his brother. "No, my lord," Dolor replied. "Let me in there, damn you. My dear brother is returned to me, twice, once from the death that I thought had befallen him on the traitor's field, and once from the death that delivered him here. Let me in."
Gilliman slammed his clawed and armoured fists against the unbreakable wall in frustration. The sound shook the cell. Vulcan looked up, brought out of his reverie, eyes as blood-red as the healing flesh of his body fixed upon Gilliman. They fixed upon the massive, clawed figure standing at the glass.
"He sees me," Gilliman said. "Let me in there." "My lord," Dolor began.
Vulcan lunged. With an anguished scream of rage and horror, he leapt up and threw himself across the cell at Gilliman. The attack was so sudden and so violent that Gilliman started back from the protective armour glass in surprise. Howling words that meant nothing and sounds that meant every pain in the galaxy, Vulcan hammered his fists against the glass until it was slippery with blood and tissue fluid from his healing, still forming flesh. His teeth were brilliant white enamel chips in his screaming mouth. His eyes were glaring circles of blood.
"Don't, brother, stop!" Gilliman cried out in alarm. "Brother, it is me. It is Rabute. Calm yourself." "He does not hear you, my lord," said Dolor miserably. "He does not hear any of us."
"The salamanders who have come to your hall were right, my lord," said Titus Prato. "Vulcan lives, but whatever he has endured, it has driven him mad. Your brother, my lord, is quite insane." that three of the Emperor's sons were present on the same world at the same precise moment was a truly auspicious conjunction, whatever the circumstances. For different reasons, none of them knew that the true number of Primarchs who had converged that day on Macragge was, in fact, four. Deep in the pitch-black, unregulated spaces of the First Legion's flagship, the Invincible Reason, the quarry exhaled slowly. It was time. Time. Visions flickered through his head like a broken, miscued picked feed. Visions had always flickered through his head since his earliest childhood. Visions of the future, of the possible, of the probable, of the next, and the next after that. It was the visions that had driven him mad. Just now, though, the visions were coming to him more cleanly. They were bearable, tolerable. They were not the prescient nightmares of a galaxy in flames and a doomed future. They were not the hellish sights of a corpse universe that came to him too often and caused him to devolve past the point where life, his or any other, retained any value. The quarry breathed carefully. The visions firing behind his blood-rimmed eyes were calm and trustworthy. The ship had translated into real space after weeks of travail through the storms of the warp, and suddenly he had clarity. He knew who he was. A lord of the dark, a master of the lightless, a night haunter. No, the night haunter. Conrad Kurz. Conrad Kurz. Conrad Kurz, he whispered to himself, speaking his name like a benediction or a death sentence. He knew who he was, and he knew his purpose. At that moment, in the bleak and bloody years of Horus's revolt, Conrad Kurz understood his purpose the most cleanly and most perfectly of all the Emperor's 18 sons. The pitiless void had shown it to him. The endless night, his friend and tormentor, had shown it to him. His dreams had shown it to him. Terror, pain, iconoclasm, all would pay, all of them, every soul, every one. They would all scream with him. The mighty Invincible Reason creaked and groaned around him as its titanic superstructure, a billion tons of alloy, settled and unstressed from the tensions of warp transit. Kurz knew where they were. He had envisioned it, so he knew that it was almost assuredly true. They occupied high orbit above the grey-sheened glory of Macragge. Macragge. Ultramar. The thought of the self-righteous Gilliman made Kurz want to piss acid. His blood brother, the Lion, was his blood enemy, as the Thramas fight had proven. But Gilliman? Toad. Reptile. Fool, as bad as Dawn, as bad as Vulcan, so blindly indoctrinated into the belief that the future would be a noble golden age, so insufferably honourable, so eager to please their father, so eager to cry, "Look at me, I have built an empire just for you, just like yours." Jump up and down all you like, little child, boast all you want. They were all going to pay. They were all going to understand the truth that only Kurz saw. He would bring them down once more in fire and fear until they were as broken as him. Perhaps, if he provoked them far enough, one of them might even kill him. Kurz was waiting for his end. He welcomed it. If he could force one of his oh-so-noble brothers to deliver it and thus reduce themselves to his level, it would serve a sweet, delinquent purpose. Gilliman. Proximity and fortune had raised him up the list of priorities. Gilliman was an icon to topple and break. Gilliman and his world along with him. Kurz closed his eyes.
Visions played. He saw the streets of Macragge Civitas carpeted with bodies. He saw the towers and spires ablaze. He saw blood. He saw... The red vision struck him with the force of arterial spray. He composed himself. It was too soon to devolve. He had work to do. He had to retain some focus. Anger was only useful when it was forged as a weapon. The same was true for terror. He knew both intimately. It was time, time to leave the ship. Now they were back in real space. The invincible reason was open and unbarred. First he had to break out of the ship. Then he had to break into Macragge. Gilliman was a toadying cur, but he was no amateur. His defences would be sound. The night haunter was not put off for a moment. Visions flowed through his head like a river, the surface shot with reflections. Curs mostly trusted them, for they were almost always true. Only occasionally, when fate shivered its spine, did a vision prove to be a false promise. He usually knew when they were lies. He certainly knew when they were questionable. He was always aware that he was playing a chance. With each vision, he had to decide if it would prove true or false, trustworthy or untrustworthy. He decided whether to act on a vision or not, and he calmly accepted when those decisions were wrong. The current stream of visions seemed particularly dependable. Curs decided to follow their hints. One in particular kept coming to him. A vision of rust, of a hard void seal, of a sign, cargo load hatch 99/2. He smiled. 16 minutes later, Curs exited the flagship's hull by shearing through the second cargo hatch of the 99th deck. The 99th was one of the unmediated spaces in which he had been sealed and hunted by his brother. The shredded hatch blew out into the near-space glow, cascading bright fragments of debris after it. Curs saw the world below, lit by the rising star. He saw the hard edges all shadows possessed in the contrast of the void. This was a stern, geometric night to haunt. He saw the orbital plates circling below the standing fleet like artificial continents. He had long since lost his helm. He simply held his breath as he flew out of the ship and bounded weightless along the skin of the hull. The sheer cold of the hard vacuum was bracing. Curs squatted beside hatch 22/3, waiting for it to open. Prescience had shown this to him too. Hatch 22/3 was where the repair crews would emerge if a cargo hatch blew on the 99th. It took them 18 seconds. The hatch opened and light shafted out. The night haunter tilted back so as not to be seen immediately. It was not a repair crew, however. It was an assault squad of dark angels, warriors wearing the marks of the Stormwing, braced with boarding shields. Curse shrugged. Sometimes the reflections were unreliable. The lion, it seemed, had anticipated that Curs would try to break out. He had set his men on alert. Full marks, brother, full marks. He would kill them anyway. Curs paused for a second to see if hatch 22/3 reconciled in any way with the recurring visions he had had of his death. Was this it? Was his last moment rushing up at him? No. His mind simmered. Confident, his death lay somewhere and somewhen else. The first dark angel pulled himself clear into the weightless space, one hand on his shield straps, the other on the hatchway rail. Curs lunged at him hard and fast, the way a shark slams into a swimmer, a crunch, a single wound trauma that nothing could survive. The night haunter's claws took away both the gorget and the throat of the dark angel as he came clear of the hatch. Vast beads of blood bobbled away into the vacuum. The man fell away limp, trailing balloons of blood, his head held on by a twist of metal and a shred of gristle. As the first victim went by, Curs took his shield from him and slammed it into the face of the warrior emerging from the hatch behind him. The impact was hard. Things broke, a skull primarily, beneath all of it. The blood oozed out of the crushed faceplate in oily, weightless bubbles. The blow knocked the man back. Kurz reached in and scooped him out through the hatch so he could get at his next kill. The dying Dark Angel was propelled away from the hull so hard that his twitching form quickly overtook the drifting, rotating corpse of the first victim and dropped towards the bright grey planet below. It began to glow blue and then burn like a shooting star. Kurz went in through the open hatch. He re-entered the ship, feet first. He was moving so fast, shadows barely stuck to him. His heels met the shield of the Dark Angel advancing behind the first two, and kicked the warrior back down the gullet of the hatch's void lock. The man dropped heavily. Landing on a foot and one knee in the gate beside the Dark Angel, Kurz slew him before he could rise again by slamming down the edge of the captured boarding shield and crushing his throat. Now there was confusion. Now there was reaction. Possibilities flew fast, and Kurz obeyed the visions. He responded, reacting to things that had not yet occurred. Two Dark Angels came at him, firing. Bolter rounds burned silently across the narrow space of the gate. Kurz could hear, through vox chatter or his visions, the outrage and profanity they were screaming because of his attack and the murder of their brothers. They wanted him dead. Their wish would be entirely denied. Kurz tilted and stopped the shoal of bolter rounds with the captured shield. One, two, three, and four, five, and six. He swatted them aside. He felt the impact of their detonations transmitted up his arm. Flickering reflections had told him where each blazing shell would be before it had even been fired. Kurz went for the poor bastards. He removed a head with the long claws of his right hand. He eviscerated a torso with the long claws of his left. Conflicting arterial geysers hosed the ceiling and wall. Another angel, a veteran of the Deathwing, rushed at Kurz. Kurz impaled him upon the claws of his left hand. Blood squirted in a torrent as the poor fool bled out around the adamantium hooks ran through his torso. The killing was only just starting. The visions told him that a great many more Dark Angels were closing in on his location. That meant that a great many more lives were about to end.
"I seldom come to this chamber," Gilliman said. "But when I do, it reassures me." The lion followed him into the room. Gilliman's cataphracty bodyguard held the broad doors open for him.
"You give me a tour of the most magnificent fortress stronghold beyond terror itself," the lion said. "And believe me, I am impressed, Rabute. But you decide that this tour should include a chamber you seldom visit?"
He stopped and looked around.
"I see," he said, nodding.
His lieutenants stood in the doorway behind him. He nodded to them, dismissing them.
"Leave us," Gilliman said to Gorod. The warriors of the bodyguard turned and closed the doors. The two Primarchs were alone for the first time.
"The Fortress of Hera is a true achievement, brother," the lion said quietly. "It is more than I could have believed. It exceeds my imaginings."
He smiled and glanced at Gilliman.
"That was not a slight, Rabute. I have never doubted your abilities, but I stand in awe of your achievements. The fortress, Macragge, the 500 worlds of Ultramar, all of it."
Gilliman pursed his lips.
"I do what I was bred to do, brother," he said. "What we were bred to do."
"Ah, that," the lion murmured, as if contemplating things that Gilliman could not possibly know.
"The fortress is robust," Gilliman went on, a little stiffly. "It serves me, and it serves my legion. It is fit for purpose."
"It is entirely and magnificently practical," the lion replied. "Truly a wonder. I have no doubt it will endure for 1,000 years or more. But you are always practical, Rabute. You, Rogel too. Men of the head, led by your brains, by your processed data, not your emotions. That's why the two of you have the best and most efficient legions in human space."
The lion tapped his brow with one long index finger.
You think, and you apply that thought, and you don't let emotions cloud you, not like Vulcan, or dear Ferris, or Jagatai.
Or Russ, Gilliman added.
Heavens, no, the lion laughed. Terra help me. Russ.
So this, the lion said, gesturing to the long table, this surprises me. A work of emotion, not logic.
The light of the late afternoon, discoloured by the storm, flooded the chamber through high windows. A long table, carved from stone, dominated the length of the room. Around it were 21 chairs, all built for the scale of a Primarch. Each one was cut from the same mountain granite as the table. The chair backs were draped with banners. The great seat at the head of the long table was draped with the pennant of Terra. Two of the other pennants were plain and made of bleached, undyed cloth. The other 18 were the banners of the Legiones Astartes.
"You did this?" the lion asked.
"Are you mocking it?" asked Gilliman.
The lion shook his head.
"It moves me. You still believe in a day when all of us, can sit at a table with our father, as equals, and talk of the matters of empire?"
"All of us," Gilliman nodded.
"You made this room in anticipation of that?"
"Yes, many years ago."
"Does that make me sentimental?" asked Gilliman.
"No, brother," said the lion. "It shows you possess a soul."
He set his hands on the back of one of the chairs bearing an undyed banner and leaned.
"Two will never come," he said.
"Yet their absence must be marked," replied Gilliman. "Places must be left for them. That is simply honour."
The lion straightened up and slowly pointed in turn at the banners of Horus, Magnus, Perturabo, Mortarion, Kurz, Angron, Alpharius, Lorgar, and Fulgrim.
"Others will never take their seats unless as conquerors," he said.
"I know," said Gilliman. "Yet their places must be kept. I believe in the Imperium, in the continuity of the Imperium."
"That it will endure."
"That it must endure. That we must make it endure."
"Without a doubt," replied the lion. "But this is a universe of uncertainty. We know the names of many of our traitor enemies, but not all."
"No.
I am certain there is more treachery to be revealed."
The lion looked at the draped banner of the 5th Legion.
"The White Scars?" asked Gilliman. "You suspect them, too?"
"The Khan is a mercurial figure. Who of us can say we know him or trust him? His nature is rebellious, and he keeps himself much apart from us. Only one brother stands close to him, and that is Lupercal. The Khan always had great affinity with Horus Lupercal."
"And on this basis?"
"Tell me your theoretical simulations have not suggested this."
Gilliman was silent.
"And don't pretend you haven't run multiple theatrical simulations on all of us, Rabute," the lion sneered.
"I won't," replied Gilliman. "You are quite correct. The projections concerning the Khan were troubling, but neither of us have heard a single whisper that he has turned to."
"We have not," the lion agreed. "But until I arrived here out of the warp storm, I had not seen confirmation of Magnus's treachery, either. That was data you could impart to me, data that you had only just come upon. We knew they had ignored the edict and that Russ's hounds had been unslipped to chastise Magnus, but neither of us knew the grim outcome, the fate of Prospero, the full disgrace of the 15th. This is a universe of uncertainties. What else do we not know?"
Gilliman paused. Then he turned to look the lion in the eye.
"You have made it plain that I am one of your uncertainties," he said.
"Brother, you mistrust me and my motives," said Gilliman. "You have told me so, clearly. You suspect me of a treason at least as great as Horus's, if not deeper."
The lion sat in the seat marked with his legion's banner and placed his armoured hands flat upon the table in front of him.
"Imperium Secundus," the lion said, staring down at his mailed hands. "You do not deny it. You are establishing a second imperium on the corpse of the first."
"No," replied Gilliman.
"No?"
"No. I am trying to keep the flame alive. This is not about empire building or thrusting for the main prize. I have an empire already. Ultramar, 500 worlds. Brother, I do this only so that we may persist. Terra may have fallen, and our father may already be dead. Whatever the facts, the ruin storm prevents us from knowing the truth. I am not taking this moment to move to my advantage, and I am not using the crisis as an opportunity to usurp. I am not Lupercal."
The lion looked up and held Gilliman's stare.
"I am simply keeping the flame alive," said Gilliman. "If we need another capital world, another figurehead, then let us have one. If it keeps our father's vision of the Imperium alive. If Terra burns, then Macragge lives. The Imperium endures. Do you know the real difference between me and Horus Lupercal, brother?"
"Tell me."
"I don't want to be emperor," Gilliman said.
The lion didn't reply.
"Help me do this, brother," said Gilliman. "Help me keep what is left together. Help me preserve the human intent. Don't make argument with me and misinterpret my motives."
"I want to trust you, Rabute," the lion replied, "but I have always been wary of your ambition."
Gilliman sighed and shook his head.
"I cannot be more open with you. It is ironic. With respect, my dear brother, you come here full of doubts about me, yet you have always been one of the most opaque amongst us. You are a man of secrets, lion, or at least of silent privacy. No one knows your mind or fully appreciates your intent, not even our father. Yet you doubt me?"
A tiny tremor of irritation crossed the lion's noble face.
"Hard words," he said.
"But true," Gilliman replied, "and perhaps I should have spoken them before now, long before. I do not doubt your loyalty or your prowess, but you and your dark angels are secretive beings, my brother, and Caliban is a world of mystery. I am wounded that you come to me with distrust when no one knows you well enough to know your heart."
"You have never spoken this way before," said the lion.
"There has never been a time before," replied Gilliman. "The universe has never closed in so tightly around us to squeeze the words out. I will be plain. I have never had the courage before. I have always been too in awe of the noble lord of the first."
"The master of the 500 worlds, in awe of me," laughed the lion.
"You know it. You know we all were. When Horus was named War Master, he did not much care that he had succeeded above me, or Rogel, or Ferris. What he truly savoured was being chosen over you."
Gilliman felt a curious wash of relief at having spoken so candidly. He saw, though he wondered if it was his imagination, that the lion seemed uncomfortable when confronted by such openness.
"Your Imperium, then," said the lion, "this Imperium Secundus, this great scheme of survival, how do you intend to proceed? Do you intend to declare yourself regent?"
"I do not," Gilliman replied. "I will not found an empire and then crown myself. Such arrogance would confirm every doubt and suspicion lurking in the minds of men like you. I need a figurehead for the public to rally around while I fight to keep the mechanisms of Imperium turning over and protected."
"But," the lion began. He looked pointedly at the great central seat, draped with its Terran standard. "Who, then? Surely it must be blood."
"Agreed," said Gilliman. "It must be a Primarch."
"My dear Rabute," said the lion, "there are only two of us here. What exactly are you proposing?"